All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fuck wads? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's everybody doing? I'm back from my Midwest jaunt. My dates in the Midwest. I will tell you about those. And we can either, I'm pretty sure I remember my speculations. I think they were pretty close. They were pretty fucking close. Today on the show, the amazing David Simon is here. Not a guy you hear talking a lot, but what an amazing talent. This guy created The Wire. Homicide, Life on the Street was based upon his book. He's done Treme. He did this thing called The Corner that some of you might remember. Generation Kill. And he started as a journalist. And it was a fascinating conversation. So that is coming down the pike towards you, into your head, right through these headphones that you're wearing, or however you're doing it, your computer, your speaker. Perhaps you're listening on a pair of old Klipsch horns, nice and loud, on a vintage couch. I don't know. That's on you. All right, before I get too caught up in whatever, I need to tell you what we did. We relaunched our site. We relaunched WTFpod.com. It's now powered by Squarespace. Go check it out. You can listen to the show there, search for anyone who's ever been on the show there. You can sign up for the newsletter there. You can buy merch. You can check my tour calendar. It's all there, all right? And it's beautiful. If you're wondering where the comments are, well, we don't have comments anymore. Sorry, unfuckable hate nerd army. Sorry. Go do some agenda-driven trolling somewhere else. I recently had a run-in with the SS / anti-Semitic division of the unfuckable hate nerd army. It was pretty exciting stuff. Pretty sad. Pretty vapid. Pretty disappointing as an American. But anyways, back to the point. You can basically on the site, you can still do everything. If you really want to comment, the link to our Facebook page is there. And I look at that and people look at that. That's basically the fan page for the show where we post the episodes. So you can still do that there. And it's just the way it's going to be. And it was actually really the way it was on the old site anyway. So you can still comment on Facebook and use the link on the new site. All right. Pretty exciting. It looks fucking cool, man. It really looks cool. So I'm back. Let's go over it. I had a pretty amazing time doing shows in Iowa City at the Mission Creek Festival. It was pretty amazing. And in Lincoln, Nebraska, also great show. Kansas City turned out to be pretty amazing. It was a big hall, as they say. It was a big old theater. But we got about 800 people in there. And what they did is the balconies were black. That's what they say. They just erased the balconies. They were just hanging over all of us as an absence of people that would have had an amazing time. How isn't it nice I'm framing it like that? But here's what goes down. Here's what happened. I flew into Iowa City or just outside of Iowa City, whatever airport that is. Took the little plane, the little one where you just you and a few other people trying not to act nervous, looking at the scenery. Looking what we're flying into, the great expanse, the space that is the middle section of this country. But I got there, checked in with the people, met Lisa Persky, the actress and now amazing photographer who was there at the festival touring with her photographs of New York from the 70s. Persky came up to me out of nowhere and just said, Sharpling sent me, told me to call you Sharky. So Sharpling, I guess, has a nickname for me, but she took me over to her show where she was going to give a talk because this Mission Creek Festival is a pretty big festival. Kevin Smith was there the day after me and introduced me to Terry Zwigoff. That was cool. Maybe I can get him in here someday. And then the show was at this beautiful little theater there, the Englert, packed it out. I guess it was about 800, 900 people. And I told you what was going to happen. I knew it was my first day out doing the long thing. And I did almost 2 hours. Just improvised, did new shit, mostly new shit, very little old shit. So stuff is coming together. We had a great time at the show. And then I got in the car the next day and drove to Lincoln, Nebraska, driving from Iowa City to Lincoln, Nebraska. I mean, you would think, I mean, some people sort of poo-poo the Midwest and the flatness, but I thought it was glorious. I live in Los Angeles. Just to be on a highway and moving, like fast, Like driving properly on a highway was a tremendous luxury because I live in this fucking place where you can never do that ever. So it was beautiful. And I wonder why people complain about it. Like, you know, people complain about the Midwest sometimes, that it's a difficult place to live, but it's just a different way of life. I mean, I found it very meditative to be driving through the flatness. And there were moments where I was like, what could people here be upset about? This is beautiful. I feel my brain breathing. But then you start to really look at it like, wow, there's really nothing out here. Oh, boy. God, this is bleak. And then you got to get back to like, look at this beautiful space. Whoa, man, what's going on out there? What's going on in that farmhouse? That can't be good. Yeah, that's the big city paranoia creeping in. When you're kind of overstimulated constantly by noises that might be gunshots, it's easy, given a little space, to become incredibly suspicious of a farmhouse. Man, everything evil that's ever existed has got to be going on in that farmhouse. Probably not. Probably just a farmer sitting there having coffee, looking despondent, waiting for the plant or whatever they call the sowing of the fields, perhaps being bitter about the other guy's fields that he sees just down the way or just past his acreage. Thinking like, that guy, he doesn't fucking know how to grow corn. I assume there's some farmer bitterness around. So I drove down to Kansas City, and I was excited about Kansas City because I wanted to eat barbecue, because that's how I use that as an excuse to eat barbecue. That's a barbecue town. So I put it out there in the world, where should I go get barbecue? And I literally did it right when I got to the hotel in Kansas City. There was a bunch of options, Oklahoma Joe's, Kansas City Joe's, whatever the Joe's was, they were closed. All right, Gates, I didn't feel like going to Gates. I've been there years ago. It's not bad. Q39, a lot of people said, but it looked a little sheeshy to me. I'm sure it's very good food. I wanted some dirty fucking KC barbecue, and Arthur Bryant's, the original Arthur Bryant's, was about a mile and a half away. And I went to that place, and I got a meat tray, got some burnt ends, got some pulled pork, and I got some fucking Kansas City ribs, a little bit of coleslaw with that amazing sauce, and some white bread and pickles, and it was fucking spectacular. Sure, there's prettier food, but is that what you want from barbecue? Or you want to go where there's a bunch of pictures on the wall of people that have been there? You could say it's a tourist attraction, but who cares? It's not really. It's the same place it's always been, and there it was. And that sauce was tangy and had a little punch to it. It's fucking spectacular. I think it's still in my intestines. So Kansas City, I was concerned, as you know, but the space was huge and beautiful. That Midland Theater, it was great. It was beautiful, beautiful old theater. All the theaters that I was in were built in the 20s. And it must have seated about 2,200. But you know, I sold 800, and that's good for me. That's about what I get in a nice small city. And the people are excited. I did some full-on neurotic improv. And I did a lot of new material. Did a few old classics, not even that old, just from the special. And met a few people outside, and it was fun. Did a few photos. All in all, a good trip, and I feel good about myself. And I feel good about the Midwest, and I feel good about America and Americans. I'm serious. It's easy to judge when you don't go. It's just there's a little more space. It's a different way of life, but the people are great people, and we had good shows. And I ran into another kid, some kid I knew from St. Some kid comes up to me. He's like, you know, do you know who I am? And I'm like, holy shit, yeah, I do. Your Mark. I used to live in the house with me in Somerville in Davis Square 30 years ago. This kid, that was a housemate of mine from 30 years ago, was there. We didn't even get along that great when we were living together. He was kind of an oddball. But man, it was great to see him. And we hung out and we talked for like an hour. And then after the show, we got some pie, talked some more, caught up. Did a little nostalgia thing. It's weird, you know, you have memories, but you gotta blow the dust off them sometimes. Get back in them. Sort of like, you know, blow the dust off and climb back into your memories full on, emotionally connected, and just, you know, get a sense of who you were and what you are now, and feel the warmth of those old mistakes and those old happy things. It was good, man. It was good. All right, so right now it's my pleasure to share with you my conversation with David Simon. I need you to know he was one of those guys. There's only been a few. Right when he walked into this garage, he picked up that old K guitar, and it was like he was seeing meeting a new friend. And, you know, that's a good way to start with me. Anytime you come in and pick up guitar, I'm like, all right, I know a little bit about this guy now. All right, this is me and David Simon. I like the fact that at some point, you know, that was the thing for you, playing
it's
guitar.
It's like the thing for every teenager. You know?
No, not really.
Well, yeah. You know.
Some guys go sports. Some guys go stupid. And then other guys that, you know, they do music.
You know, I if I could have done anything that wasn't derivative, like that wasn't a learned riff from somebody else.
But you got to start there.
I never got past that. I mean, I can string riffs together, but
right.
I cannot do the thing of truly improvising. My son can play jazz piano.
Jazz is a whole different level, but yeah. What were you playing, blues mostly?
Yeah, blues and sort of blues rock, mostly blues.
Yeah, I think how old are you, 54?
Yeah, 55.
So we're about the same age. So you were in college when you played? Guitar, you started when you were a kid.
I started when I was like 12.
Yeah, me too, right? So,
what was your first album?
Weirdly, I think my first might have been the Beatles' second album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know why. And then I remember having
Roll Over Beethoven.
Yeah, that Roll Over Beethoven was like, that was it, the Chuck Berry beginning.
Yeah.
I like learning that was the most important thing in my life. And I didn't learn until high school, and it's pretty simple.
I know.
You too?
Well, yeah, I mean, I love Chuck Berry.
Right?
And it was a big deal to me to learn that stuff. But the Chicago blues stuff is what sort of caught me very early.
The older stuff or the Muddy and Howlin' Wolf?
Like classic, you know, five-member band, Little Walter, all that
stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was my shit. And I found them largely the usual route through the Rolling Stones,
right.
Creedence. And I was, you know, I just could never, I could copy stuff, but I could never bring any insight to it musically. You know, I mean, I was just always thinking... I was in my high school jazz band.
Yeah.
And I was always like a half a measure behind the band, you know, like, oh, shit. No, they meant flatted seventh, ninth. You know?
Yeah, I couldn't
play shells. But my son can't. I mean, he plays guitar and piano, and he's relentless.
Is he in a band?
He actually, he's in college now, and he's been playing, he's not the front man. He's the keyboard player and kind of one of the arrangers and songwriters for a Stax Volt.
Oh, yeah?
11-piece Stax Volt.
Really?
In Boston. And, they're coming to the end of their run because they're all getting ready to graduate.
Right, right, right.
So it's like, but I think he's going to go into music.
So that's a proud thing, like when the son kind of picks up and does something amazing that you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, it's in the tradition because my dad wanted to be a newspaper reporter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't know that... by osmosis, I chose that to sort of please him,
mm-hmm.
but it happened, and so.
What was the first thing that compelled you to do that? I mean, like, when did your dad do? He never did any journalism, or he did?
No, he did briefly. He was the managing editor of the paper at NYU and
right.
a journalism major. And
what year? So that would have been back a bit,
30s,
yeah,
in the late 30s,
right?
And he graduated and. Went to work. He was a stringer, I know, for the Hudson County Dispatch, and he was freelancing
uh-huh.
in New York, around New York, and trying to get picked up on a paper. And then the war,
yeah.
And then he went into the Army. And when he came out of the Army, my brother was born in 46 pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And he needed to get...
Make money.
Yeah, a little bit more than you could be for being a newspaper.
Right, head. Right.
So he went into PR. But he ended up being a public relations guy and dealing with reporters. There were reporters over my house all the time.
What did he PR for?
A Jewish service organization named B'nai B'rith.
I know B'nai B'rith.
You know B'nai B'rith?
Yeah, the BBYO.
Yeah,
B'nai B'rith Youth Organization.
Were you in BBYO?
No, I was in the other one, the younger, USY.
Oh, USY.
Right? Was that what it's called? United Synagogue Youth.
Yeah.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Briefly.
Well, he was the PR director. That's what moved us from New York to Washington. He was the PR director for the whole organization, the International.
Uh-huh.
It was a sort of umbrella group.
And how Jewish were you brought up?
Bar mitzvah.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, suburban Jewish.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, when did you see the Coen Brothers movie?
Yes,
the
Serious one, Man.
Serious
Man. Oh, yeah. You're like, isn't that the most familiar thing you ever saw in your life?
I'm watching it. I'm thinking, this is a documentary. You know, this is a goddamn documentary. And it was just so beautifully, you know, it's the story of Job.
Yeah,
it's just
right.
It's so beautifully rendered
yeah.
that I'm watching it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, right down to the.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, right down to the, you know, going to.
Yeah.
You to go to Hebrew school, like, you know, when you're 12 or 13, it's just like you can't bear it
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, just, you know, where's my marijuana?
Yeah. I was a terror to Hebrew school teachers. I did. I mean, it was like, it wasn't real school, so you might as well, you know, just push the buttons of the teachers. I just was the worst.
Well, it was just that you'd sort of burned out. You'd done the whole, you know, I wrote a piece in Sports Illustrated last year.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was a baseball player in my youth who was Jewish,
yeah,
for the Washington Senators when, yeah, I was growing up, Mike Epstein. He,
yeah,
actually played for Oakland.
All I heard about was Sandy Koufax for my entire life.
Right,
the,
sure,
only Jewish baseball,
sure,
player.
Yeah, there weren't, yeah, many, so, yeah, you gathered around them. But we, you know, to have this power hitting first baseman playing for my, you know, terrible local team, he was such a hero to me.
Yeah.
And I actually had the moment of praying to God in the men's room, the
yeah,
boys' room,
yeah,
of Rock Creek Forest Elementary School,
yeah,
saying, "Dear God, if you let Epstein hit a home run right now, I will never skip Hebrew school again." And he jacked one into the upper deck in right field. And I remember, I can still see my face, like, cheering in that oxidized, screwed up mirror.
Yeah.
But, you know, and all of a sudden I realized, oh no, what did I just promise God, you know? Because, of course, I was skipping Hebrew school, like, right, you know, 2 weeks later.
Now you got to get on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, so after that, Epstein got traded to Oakland, and then the whole team moved and became the Texas Rangers. So clearly, the Old Testament God was not going to be appeased by my performance, you know? If you've ever, like, tried to read a few pages of Talmud, and I have, because it's such an interesting dynamic of, like, hi, we're going to basically treat this like a legal text.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to figure out the Torah and figure it out down to, like, you know,
yeah,
and we're going to, you know, majority opinions, dissenting opinions, dissenting yeah, on dissent. And you read it and you realize, my God, this is thousands of years of
arguing
of my dinner table of arguing of like five Jews, seven opinions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So you, well, yeah, it was heated when you grew up.
Yeah, but like, but never malevolent. Argument
right,
was sport. My brother said it best. Argument was sport.
Was just the two of you?
No, I had a sister. She passed away
Sorry.
Of cancer. But there were three of us, and I was much younger. My brother is 14 years older than me. My sister was 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the kid. And so, like, a lot of the arguments were flying over my head, but you absorb this stuff.
Mostly politics or what?
Yeah, politics. I mean, I have distinct memories of being 8 years old and hearing the fury at the table in 1968. You know, my sister was...
About the war?
Yeah, my sister was for Kennedy. My brother was for McCarthy. And my father was for Humphrey.
And all Democrats.
Well, listen, it was gradations of liberal.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Gradations of Jewish liberal.
Yeah.
Of New Deal Democrat.
Right,
liberal.
Right.
And that was my childhood. And
did you find... when did your interest become sort of engaged about it? Because what did you do when you went to college? What did you study when you were playing guitar?
I started as a journalism major.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be a newspaper reporter from, I guess, 13, 14. I sort of became interested in it.
Just because of your dad or something else?
It was just in the ether of my house. It was floating around. I mean, we took three newspapers.
Yeah.
You know, we took the Times on Sunday. We took the Washington Post, Washington Star. We discussed current events, you know. We discussed the writers in the paper.
Really? Your family was that engaged, that sophisticated? It's nice.
It was, you know, there were three book. It was a, you know, basically a three bedroom rancher with,
yeah,
you know, where there were wall to wall bookshelves on about three rooms.
Right.
And it was just, you know, my father was not somebody who, you know, he had a depression sort of sensibility about the world. You know, when it came to, like, sort of haute cuisine or, like, you know, come on. Food was invented in 1945. We there's nothing you can show me that's like he always felt like it was all a game being
right.
Or, you know,
was he able to enjoy things?
But that was what I was going to say is that, but, you know, a hardback book, that's worth whatever you want to charge me for it.
Right.
You know, a paperback, why would I want to own a paperback when I could own yet another hardback? That was the house. It was a house of argument and idea.
Uh-huh.
And it was. I'm grateful for it. It was
well,
fun.
It was interesting because I you know, Obama sat there. You know,
I know.
And then I watched your...
By the way, this chair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but all you, right. I mean, but he summoned you, you know, right?
They didn't let me sit in his chair.
Right, well, you probably could have, didn't ask.
I had to come out to Highland Park for that.
Well, good. But I watched that thing. It was a very interesting thing. Do you know why that happened?
I know exactly what happened.
Let me just set it up a little bit. So you were asked by the president to just have a conversation. He wanted to pick your brain about drug policy in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of a stage thing in the sense of
could tell by the shots.
Yeah, there was this 1 day conference.
Yeah,
and I normally don't like to get involved in sort of government. You know, you can be conferenced to death and nothing ever happens.
Right.
But every now and then, this was because the sponsors were everybody from like Newt Gingrich to Donna Brazile. It was this truly bipartisan thing about trying to reduce the prison population.
Right,
and of course that's been my thing for about 15 years.
Would you consider that your primary agenda? Politically?
If I have a specific thing that I've sort of focused on, it would be ending the drug war and trying to, you know, I'm talking down the drug war every chance I get.
Right.
And trying to reduce the prison population and end zero tolerance and militarized policing and all that stuff. I think it's been a disaster for the country. So here comes this moment, and I really don't want to get involved, but they say, look, we have a real chance of doing this in the last 2 years of the presidency.
Right.
Why don't you do 10 minutes on a panel there. And like I reluctantly said yes. And once I said yes to the group, which was sort of an adjunct of administration people, this call came from the White House. They said, instead of his usual remarks to the luncheon, you know, where he tapes 6 minutes, the president would instead like to have a conversation with you. So you know, figure out how to say yes, you know, or maybe even yes, sir.
But what were your feelings initially?
My initial feeling was, if this is actually going to happen, I have to wear a
jacket,
a sport coat, and a tie. You know, my second thought was, my son's going to want to come with me to the White House,
right?
And so he came down from college; he's in college.
Were you excited to talk to the president, though?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Listen, I admire this guy.
Yeah,
I do. I mean, I'm a lefty Democrat,
mm-hmm.
And I've said. And I think sort of the last 8 years have borne me out. I think this is a good man and a wise man. And I think he's in a rigged system.
Yeah.
And I think it was sort of surprising to hear him say that in the State of the Union. He was basically saying, it doesn't matter. It's not all about who we elect. It's about what the system is at this point.
And also thinking about the fucking future. Right. I mean, it's like, you know, sometimes you see the kind of the lack of movement because of ideology, principles, and money, where you're like, doesn't anyone realize that, you know, we're supposed to live on?
Well, Ed Burns, my writing partner on The Wire, he had a very good line about this. He said, nobody plants olive trees in American politics, which is, hey, I'm going to plant this tree, and in 7 years, you might get an olive.
Yeah.
You know? But there's no other way. If you want an olive, there's no other thing to do but plant the tree and be patient.
Yeah.
And there is no policy that is seriously considered by this country if it can't yield something before the next congressional election cycle. It's so cynical.
And we have to assume that, you know, they may be morons, but they can't be that nihilistic.
I don't think they're morons. I think the money has trapped them, which is to say, the Supreme Court basically said, please, you know, purchase our government at whatever rate and whatever, you know, level of expenditure you wish.
Yeah.
Said that to Mast Capital. And if you read this piece by Steve Israel in the New York Times, is he's leaving, and he's basically saying, good news, you'll be able to take my phone calls now in my district without me hocking you for money, because, you know, the hours that we spend just chasing the dollars so that we can throw $2 million into this race, and they throw $2 million, and then we throw another $2 million. You know, what they've opened up, the Pandora's box of money, it's destroyed one of the branches of government. The presidency is still the presidency.
Right.
You know, it's still a populist notion.
Right.
You know, get the votes, get the electoral college. The Supreme Court, whether you agree with these nine justices or not, it's still what it is. Congress is just paid for. It's just bought.
Yeah.
The legislative branch of our government is
a money laundering operation.
It's been given over to capital.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and capital is there to preserve profit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing more sociopathic than that.
And when you approach this, you know, creatively or with, you know, your projects, you take these ideas. I mean, you know, obviously the purchasing of the government and the prison industrial complex, you know, are sort of two sides. That's part of that.
Right. I mean, certainly the privatization of prisons was, you know, I mean, the notion that the product could be human incarceration shows you the level of sort of psychic disease that can be applied. You know, I mean, capitalism is not a moral force.
No.
How we ever mistook it for that. You know,
it's sort of the opposite.
But it's the opposite. It doesn't mean that, like, it's not the most effective way of generating mass wealth in the modern world.
Yeah.
clearly it's demonstrated it's great facility for that.
Well, the interesting
but what you do with the money,
right?
That's how that's the definition of society,
right?
Or what you don't do with the money,
right? Well, this whole idea that privatization and the free market will find its level and the most moral thing will win out was retarded.
It's ridiculous.
What about greed? I mean, it's one of the seven deadlies. I mean, what do you think people do?
You ever get in an argument with a libertarian?
It's annoying. I don't have the patience for it or the skill set anymore.
There is no skill set. There's no skill. But the one thing they always rely on is like it'll invariably you'll start pointing out where like look at what happened when you let capital address the system of incarceration. They made human misery into a product, and they went to Wall Street with it and they said, hey, we can guarantee you 3% growth next year.
Yeah.
That's 3% more of the population going to jail.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How do you do that? Well, you got to make more nonviolent crimes jailable.
Right. And mostly poor people, mostly people of color.
Course. Yeah. Of course. It's insane. And yet, when you talk, they'll look at you and they'll go, oh, well, that's crony capitalism. Like, wait a sec.
Is there another kind?
Of course. Tell me the society in human history that ever applied capitalism in some sort of benign way that wasn't mitigated by the society saying, look, here's our priorities, here's our moral standards, here's what we want to do, here's what we don't want to do. Figure it out. You know, the crony capitalism is like, no, it'll once the markets get it pure.
Yeah, pure markets.
You guys are batshit crazy, man.
Yeah.
And I think citizenship in some very basic ways. You know, if you're talking to me about those wonderful watchwords of freedom and liberty, and you're not like, there's not a corresponding sense of responsibility, all that is to me is it's just a recipe for an incredibly selfish culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the other hand,
it's happened.
Know, if it's all responsibility and no freedom, that's tyranny. But somewhere in the middle is something that, you know, Jesus, the Athenians recognized it as being sort of a fundamental of the democratic state. You know, you got to kick in and you got to kick in. And, you know, if somebody down the road is getting the shit kicked out of them wrongly, you're marginalized, even if you don't feel it. Even if it's happening to somebody else, a little lower on whatever the pyramid of pain is.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment that you don't stand up for that guy, it's closer to you.
Right.
And that, I mean, it's just something that is so elemental, and yet so many people don't stand up.
Right. Because the ideology is it's not my problem.
Yeah. In fact, he's different from me.
Right. Well, even worse because that's loaded.
Yeah.
You know, not my problem is just selfish. It's not my problem because he's different than me is exclusionary racist.
Yeah. And we're still living through those times.
No, absolutely. Amazing. So when you, go back to the career, because I, you know, how do you like show business? You good with it?
How do you like being a whore? It's not bad. You know, it's not bad.
But do you really feel that?
The pay's okay.
Yeah.
I'm having a good run. And for the most part, what I get to do is meaningful to me. There are things that I have trouble getting made that would be even more meaningful at times.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed by the projects that can't find favor because they can't be maximized as entertainment.
Like, what is that? But you did all right. The last thing you did, Show Me a Hero, was relatively
improbable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. I don't mean to be, I'm not. You know, I understand I occupy a very weird sinecure.
Well, you know what was interesting from my experience with The Wire, and, you know, and it happened a bit with Tremé, though I haven't had the follow through with Tremé, was with The Wire, which is, you know, which I obviously heard a lot about, and, you know, I didn't watch it when it was on, because what I would do is I'd be on HBO or whatever, and I'd watch an episode, then maybe a few weeks later I'd watch another one. I'm like, I have no idea what this show's about.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, what happened to me was, you know, I got all of them, you know, from Netflix, and I just started at the beginning, and then I couldn't do anything for 3 weeks. Like, I had to watch every one of them in order.
And we obviously didn't have a plan for that. That was not our plan.
I know, but there was no other way to watch it.
In a way, yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing you had going for it, if you had HBO, was, you know, they were showing it 5 times a week.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if you miss it Tuesday, catch it Thursday.
Right, but that being said, when I watched it the way I watched it, it was as compelling as reading an amazing novel or reading, you know, almost a nonfiction about these layers of society and the organization of hierarchies
turned out we were optimized for that. But when we started doing the show, DVD box sets were not even a thing. And downloads certainly were just a gleam in anybody's eye. So we got lucky. But I think that's true. What I'm doing, I'm always arguing that, look, if you let us make it, it'll go on the shelf and people will find it. People will eventually, you know, they'll calm down about the fact that, you know, you actually have to, the music actually is part of the point of Tremé. And I mean, I love all my children kind of equally.
Yeah.
They'll find, the Marines all found Generation Kill and turned people onto it. And
got some respect.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I don't think I'm. I think I keep executing at a pretty high level, and I'm pretty happy with the material. But I do. I don't expect anything to find favor right away. I expect it to get sort of good reviews by the people who have to attend to it professionally.
Yeah,
and then to go quietly slip below the waves, and then word of mouth to kick it up. Well, to ratchet it up.
Let's talk about this sort of the transition, because I mean, you were a real journalist. You know, you over well you
a reasonable take, a reasonable facsimile thereof.
But yeah. But you believed in it.
I still do.
And your commitment to proper investigation and proper reporting, you know, specifically, you know, in Baltimore and early on into the world that you were dealing with, narco crimes, right? Mostly. Yeah. That, you know, you were on your way, and you were, as a young man in your 20s, you were going to be that guy.
I was going to grow old on the copy desk. I mean, I wanted to be a newspaperman.
And you loved it.
I loved it.
And so what ultimately began to disintegrate or fall apart for you to make the transition that you made?
Well, out-of-town ownership for my newspaper. My newspaper got bought by the LA Times, which at the time...
Is it Baltimore Sun?
Yeah. At the time, they said... Oh, you got bought by the good chain. You know, thank God you didn't get by. It wasn't Gannett. It was the LA Times.
Right.
These people are good.
Yeah.
And
well, that's what people tell themselves, that, you know, as Rome falls. Like, this is okay. Hitler's okay.
Well, yeah. It's
we'll just work with them. We'll work with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they're going to be fine.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right.
Okay, they broke a few windows. It's not going to get worse. So there was a little bit of... And at first, there was sort of a hands-off. They were very touchy-feely at first with us. But slowly, the management of the paper, you got the impression that they were from out of town, and their sense of the city was not of a place that they were covering to be intelligent or comprehensive about what the actual problems were, and like address and explain anything. They were chasing prizes. They were like, if I can win two or three Pulitzers, then I'll get the bump and I'll go to a... I'll go to another paper in the chain, a bigger, you know, I'll get out of Baltimore. And so, like, you would see this sort of prize culture taking over.
It's also like this weird kind of selfish careerism.
Well, and it's not the stuff that readers actually either need or care about.
Right.
You know, the and so there was some hyped stories, and there was a guy making stuff up, the usual shit.
Yeah. Who you used as a basis for a character.
Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah.
But... The other thing was the stuff that I really valued, which was starting to become sort of very delicate narrative, and the idea of trying to pull actual human-sized people through the keyhole of journalism and do these narratives where, and I wanted to make you care about a guy like Bubbles, who was based on a guy that
the fake guy lives down the street here.
The fake
Andre.
Guy? Andre Royal?
Yeah, he's been in here. He lives a couple miles away.
Does he really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a hard time picturing him in L.A. I really do.
It is difficult. And, you know, when he came in here, it was just this ball of New York energy. It was great.
I know.
Yeah, his wife owns a restaurant, Natwater.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's doing good.
That's great.
Yeah.
Say hi for me.
I will.
Say hi for me.
I will. So the real Bubbles.
Yeah, I mean, it's like at a certain point, what I valued in journalism had no, you know, what they valued was the Baltimore Sun has learned, and as a result of an investigation, they're going to hold committee meetings and can hand us our prize now.
Yeah.
There was almost a formula to it. It came out of Philly. It came out of the Gene Roberts School of Journalism of this is how you win a prize.
You break it and then let it.
And then for a year you report about how important your reporting is. You know, they were masters of that. If you didn't do the follow-up reporting to say how great your reporting was and how important, how relevant the Baltimore Sun was.
Right.
They got mad. They got mad. And so I started looking at this. I started feeling, this is not, okay, we were not, we were a stodgy paper. We were a little bit greater than the sum of our, or smaller than the sum of our parts, I should say. The Baltimore Sun was a gray thing.
Yeah.
Mencken used to say the morning paper. He was on the evening paper. He used to say we wrote like accountants.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of truth to that. But it was a very honest paper.
Yeah.
And we used to sit around and argue about what was fair and what was right. And sometimes when we didn't have the story, we spiked it. And we didn't...
What does that mean, spike it?
You hold the story because you don't have it yet.
Right.
You know, you need... You know.
And you'd have those debates.
Yeah. I mean, like, by the way, that's an unheard of dynamic with the internet now. I mean,
sure.
You know, there's nobody saying, you know what, I only heard this from one person. Maybe I should actually check it out.
Yeah. No.
It's going right up on Vulture. It's going right up on...
And the weird thing is I don't think consumers can really tell the difference between anything. That, you know, like a story comes from, or there's no gauge and there's no rule to it.
No, I mean, I knew we were in a brave new world when I was... At one point, I looked at my Wikipedia entry and I was married to Howard Stern's ex. Me. I was.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's another guy named David Simon.
Right.
Who, you know...
How was that for you for the weeks that was up?
I didn't much care. I was amused by it.
Yeah.
You know, my wife less so.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But on a really basic level, okay, this can happen now. Because, mm-hmm. again, it's the Wild West.
And people can cherry pick the information that fits their ideology and run with it like it's the truth. And that's how you get like these camps of thought that are based on garbage.
Yeah. Now, listen, journalists could do that. But usually there was a consensus within the newsroom when a guy was doing it too often and to a greater degree. Eventually somebody challenged him, or eventually somebody spiked a story.
Right.
And I mean, I saw it happen. Some of the moments I've been most proud of in journalism were stories that didn't run and that shouldn't have run.
Right.
There came a point at which the newspaper that I had grown up at and that I loved had sort of ceased to be. And what was replacing it, what they regarded as valuable journalism, I had no regard for, and what I regarded as valuable. It was time to go. At about the same time, my first book had sold to NBC, and Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana.
That was the Homicide book?
Yeah, and they had come into town to film that show.
And did you reach out to Barry Levinson because he was a Baltimore guy?
Yeah. The book came out here,
Did you have time to write the book? Would you take a break?
I took a year's leave to go to the Homicide Unit.
Was that for the paper or just because you were like, I got to do something else?
It was both. I mean, in the sense of, we had just gone through a strike and I was sort of mad at management, and I thought, this would be good to sort of walk.
And you were a big union guy.
Yeah, I'm a big union guy. So we had just, we were the most profitable we'd ever been at that point in time. And they were cutting our medical because that's how they do.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit mad. And at the same time, don't want to give up a daily newspaper job at a major paper. For cause, you get a book contract, you can take a year's leave of absence.
Right.
So I went into the Homicide Unit in 88 to write the book and write my first book. But it was also, it made me, it obviously gave me a ton of sources in the police department.
Yeah.
Hang out in the
they let you. How long did it take to sort of develop a trust amongst them?
10 days.
Oh yeah,
they're so busy up there. They're working 200 at that time, 240 murders a year. They're
unbelievable.
So, they're so busy.
Yeah,
the 36 guys up there. That it was like they had 5 days of wariness, 5 days of like teasing me and torturing me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, it was like sort of like
the test.
Yeah, after they got through the 5 days of like batting me around like a mouse. The cats all had to go back to work.
Right.
And it was like, then your furniture. So that was actually, the second book was a little longer for obvious reasons because we went to a drug corner to do the drug war.
Now, the first book, so it gets bought by NBC, was it?
Yeah, and I didn't take it seriously. I mean, I was like, well, that's great.
Maybe. How did it happen? Who brokered it? Your agent? How does that?
Yeah, it went to CAA, and they tried to sell it for feature, and nobody was buying.
For a film?
Yeah, nobody was buying. And
it was too big, probably. How are you going to render that?
600 pages.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm on the rewrite desk at the Sun. I'm working night shifts that week.
Right.
What do I know?
And even when NBC buys it, doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, well, it wasn't NBC. It was actually Levinson's company bought it and took it. He had a deal to make something for NBC. I think he was going to make Diner into a one-hour drama.
Those were the choices? Homicide or Diner?
Well, they didn't want Diner. They didn't see the drama in that. By the way, it might have been a great show.
Sure, it was a great movie.
But then he came back to them. It was Gail Mutrix in his office, one of his associate producers, who read the book, handed it to him. But I did have the one moment of saying, why don't you send it to Barry Levinson? He's from Baltimore.
Right.
Like, that was my big moment of, you know, I could have just easily said, why don't you send it to John Waters? You know, he's from Baltimore.
That would have been a very different show.
Very different show.
Yeah.
And John's a friend. John's a friend, but no. We sent it to the right guy.
Yeah. And then it goes in, and then they decide to make it. And how do they bring you in initially? What is the offer? What is...
At first, Gail actually said, do you want to try to write the pilot? And
right.
I said, you know, do you take me for a fool? I've never written anything. I've never even written
a script.
A one-act play for, like, you know...
you're a reporter.
For a retirement party. Right. The Sun. I have, you know, I have nothing.
Yeah.
And I said, but you know what? I do know the world. Once you get a bunch of templates of several scripts by somebody who knows what they're doing, show them to me and I'll take a shot at one.
Yeah.
But even then, I thought of it as a lark. And when they offered me a script assignment that first year, I called up my friend Dave Mills, who I worked on the college paper with.
Yeah.
He was a reporter at the Washington Post. And he was always the guy who, when we were putting out the college paper, he would like have to stop for an hour and stop writing headlines on his pages to go watch Hill Street Blues.
Right.
You know, he was that guy.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, you follow this better than I do. You want to take a shot at this? And so we wrote a script in about 2 weeks. And it was so depressing and so dark a script that NBC wouldn't make it. And they held it for, they spiked it basically.
Yeah.
And second season, I think it was Mark Johnson, Barry's producing partner at the time, went and talked to Robin Williams, who had done Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah.
And showed him the script. And Robin Williams wanted to do the guest spot of the husband whose wife is killed in front of him.
Yeah.
And at that point, NBC said, oh, yeah, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
So
that was your script.
Yeah, and it won the WGA award. And
right.
Like David Mills immediately like quit the Post and went to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Came out here and just kept sending me notes that said, you know, you're an idiot.
Yeah,
but I didn't take it seriously, and I went back and I reported the second book, and I went back to the paper and
the Corner.
Yeah, and then
well, it wasn't to you. You didn't take it seriously primarily because it was entertainment, right?
Yes, it was apostasy.
Yeah,
Bernie Simon did not raise me to be a TV writer. You know, he raised me to like you know
make a difference.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know,
or be a pursuer of truth.
Something or write prose, you know, basically, I mean, I used to, when I was at the Sun those early years, I used to go back for, you know, Friday night dinner at my parents' house and we'd sit around and, you know, my brother is, significantly smarter than I am. He's a physician. He's a medical researcher. He's the head of the infectious disease department at Johns Hopkins University.
Oh, wow.
My sister was a fine artist, a painter who was exhibited, you know, had a master's in fine art, taught, you know, legitimately, you know, meaningful artist.
Yeah.
I'm the newspaper hack.
Yeah.
And we'd sit around the table and my dad would look, you know, my dad had nothing, you know, nothing to say about de Kooning to my sister and nothing to say about medical research to my brother. And he would look at me and go, so you used a Geron lead, you know? You seem to be leaning hard on the Geron leads.
What is that?
You know, what is that?
Yeah. What is a Geron lead?
It's like beginning with like, you know, an ING word.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, last three leads have been Geron leads. You're leaning a little hard on that, Davey. Like, this he knew. This is like he could engage with. So, right. You know, it was Dad, I'm going to become a TV writer.
Yeah.
That's my move.
Is he around? Did he?
Yeah, he saw it all happen.
He did.
he died about 5 years ago. The Wire had started. The Wire had started. At that point, he was a little astonished about what I was doing. He never got over the profanity.
Oh.
He was a very gracious man. And
it's hard for them to see through that.
When the book, Homicide, when I showed him the gallows and he went through the pages, he carefully edited out even the ones in quotes, he edited out all the profanity. And the one that I'll never forget, which I loved him so hard when I read this page, a detective, or it was actually my pro, somebody was referred to as being pissed drunk.
Yeah.
And he literally put in drunk to the point of urination.
He didn't understand the phrase.
Yeah. And even if he did, it was like, we can get there another way and we can do it with dignity. You know, you just don't be a potty mouth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Dad, I'm sorry. I've been in Baltimore too long. And, you know, the homicide unit has to sound like the homicide unit.
Did he let you off the hook?
I don't think he ever reconciled to. And the other thing is my dad was from that era of, you know, I grew up with Vietnam, with Watergate, mm-hmm. with I.F. Stone being a hero, you know, yeah. Stone, like, you know, you expect a certain amount of lying from your government. Mm-hmm. And you, the trick is, you know, all governments lie, as mm-hmm. Stone says. The trick is to parse the ones out that are the most egregious and to correct the ones that are merely mistakes and to credit them when they actually tell the truth and to be able to tell the difference. And that's the job.
Yeah.
But my dad was from an era where, like, he used to love it when I wrote feature stories that were like happy stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember my dad was doing freelance work into the 50s and 60s. And, you know, one of his stories was like, his stories would be like, there was a lot of the bridge they said couldn't be built, you know, about the Verrazano Narrows in
right.
New York. It was like, you know, affirming, he would have loved Stephen Ambrose.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I don't know if Stephen Ambrose, but like, can do.
Right. America can, you well, know, and human. You know,
and yeah. he loved the politician. Like, you know, he the stories he would tell were about, like, affirming stories about authority.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't authoritarian, but he...
But he wasn't ignorant.
No, not at all. But he wanted to trust and he wanted to believe in the good of people.
And you have that.
Some. I certainly feel like most people are good. And I feel like even a lot of... Like, I even have affection for... Like, people who are in classes that everybody sneers at, the heroes who show me a hero for mm-hmm. me are the bureaucrats.
Yeah,
they're bureaucrats. So I have some of that, but my dad really like was worried. Even in the last years of his life, at one point I was writing some stuff that was very critical of police policy in Baltimore. And,
yeah,
and I remember him saying to me, he goes, "The police are going to get mad at you," and I was like, you know, yeah. They'd be fools not to. Yeah. He goes, "Well, are you going to be okay?" I'm going to be like, "Yeah." You know,
but was he worried about your personal physical safety on some level,
or that there would be a comeback? Or,
right.
Yeah,
right.
He was worried. He was worried for me.
Well, that's usually what parents do.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I mean, you know, I guess journalism had changed. Journalism had become much more adversarial as a result of Vietnam, as
right.
the Pentagon Papers. You know, I mean, Watergate. And rightly so, you know, by necessity it needs to be adversarial. But my dad was, for somebody who wanted to be a newspaper reporter and who could write, you know, he taught me a lot about writing. He was a very good writer.
Mm-hmm.
He nonetheless, the temperament of modern journalism, mm-hmm. foam from the lip of a mad dog, as Mencken once yeah. referred to it.
Well, he was like a New Deal guy, right? Your dad,
yeah.
You know, like, look what we did.
Right.
You know, we rebuilt it. We got people working and, you know, it's okay.
Right. Well, you know, the people that he loved were, like, he used to say to me at times, "Can't you write more of the features? You have such a nice light touch with features, you know?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I can. And sometimes I do. But, you know, Dad, look, I just pulled, you know, the grand jury information on Clarence Mitchell. I know what they're investigating for." And he'd be like, "You're not supposed to have grand jury information. That's illegal." I'm like, "Yeah, isn't it great?" He'd be like, no, give it back." I'm like, "No, I'm not giving it back."
Yeah. He didn't want you to get hurt.
He didn't want me to get hurt.
Yeah.
It's a very Jewish parenting.
So from the beginning, were you creator of Homicide?
No.
They just bought the...
They bought the book.
Yeah.
Paul Attanasio wrote the pilot script and the show. It was show run by Tom Fontana with an assist from Barry.
Now, for the sake of you know, writers and people who are, you know, trying to do something relevant in television, I mean, what was the process of your education? I mean, you know, outside of being sent some spec scripts or some functioning scripts and writing with your partner.
I sent the scripts into Tom and it came back with red ink and this works, this doesn't. Oh my God, what are you trying to do here? You know, this.
And you like Tom?
Tom's my mentor as far as a TV writer. I like him. He kept every promise to me. He was committed to growing us as writers and producers. He was thank God I went to work for him.
He taught you how to write an effective script and to be a showrunner.
Yeah, and you know, Jimmy Finnerty, his producing partner, taught us the practicals of production. And I worked under some very smart playwrights, you know, Jimmy Ashimura and Eric Overmeyer and Julie Martin. Everybody I was working under was teaching me stuff. One of the things they did was, I remember Jimmy Ashimura said, "You got to read plays." You know, that's how you, and you know, I'd read some when I was in college. You know, I'd read sort of the obvious ones. I took a Shakespeare course. You know, I'd read some Chekhov, but not enough.
Yeah.
And that was really good grooming.
What sense? What did you take from it?
You understand pacing.
Yeah.
And you understand how to bring people on. and take people off of stage. And it's not the same as TV. I mean, the little words cut to make television and film a little bit different dynamic. The blocking is obviously very different. But, you know, in drama, every line, every word has to justify itself. You can have an aside in a prose article.
Right.
And not completely die as long as you do it elegantly.
Right.
There's no asides in drama.
It's all got to serve the story.
Yeah. You know, if you go aside from the story, you have to know that you're doing it. It has to be incredibly measured, and you have to get in and get out very fast.
And when when you had the time and the expanse of The Wire, being lean is one thing, but you also knew you had this amazing arc of narrative.
Right. Well, that's what it gives you Homicide was a very well-written show.
Yeah.
But it was 22.
Yeah, minutes, right?
It was 45 minutes. It was 22 episodes.
Right.
So it was like basically a series of linked short stories.
Right.
If you treat a season of television, even a shortened season, like the 10 or 12 or 13 episodes of HBO, as one story, that's, the whole, all three Godfather movies, including the bad one, aren't 9 hours.
Right.
So now you can create a universe.
Right.
Now you can take a little bit more of a breath than you otherwise would. Yeah.
And you knew that from going in.
Yeah.
You're like, great. Now we can sort of spread it, open it up.
Right. I mean, it's the one thing when I was working on Homicide, I used to feel like this episode was great. I wish we could stay here instead of go do something.
Yeah.
So there was, The Wire was an opportunity to do that. Well, actually, the miniseries, was.
Ed Burns is somebody you knew from before?
Ed was a cop. He was a homicide detective, and he became, over time, a source of information for me. I met him. He had done a wiretap case on a guy named Little Melvin Williams, a huge drug dealer in Baltimore. He just passed away in December, Melvin did.
Yeah.
And Ed was one of the lead investigators in the case, and I was assigned to do a series of articles on Melvin because his career had spanned decades.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I met Ed. And just straight on, this is a source of information. And over time, I came to really enjoy him. He thought differently from a lot of the institutionalized police. A lot of other police would have said, he's a fucking asshole. But but I loved him. I thought he was, he was a guy who was thinking in big circles about what they were doing. He was a Vietnam vet. He'd been on that losing fight. He was in the drug war. He saw that as a losing fight. He then went to be a school teacher after 20 years in the department, and he saw that battle in a middle school in Baltimore, sort of close up. He's an interesting cat, and that's how. At a certain point, when I was ready to do The Corner, I thought this is the guy to do it with because he already had the same doubts about the drug war.
Right, and The Corner was how many episodes?
Oh well, I mean, we did the book together. We went to Monroe and Fayette for a year in 1993.
Yeah.
And then it was six, sold it to HBO and it was six episodes.
And he was your production partner in that as well?
No, actually at that point, he had gone to teaching.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering this correctly.
Yeah.
That was when he was working because we had done the reporting after he got his teaching certificate and before he'd gone to. And to be blunt, HBO was really scared of doing that project with a white guy, two white guys who had written the book.
The Corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was a book about, a predominantly African-American community deluged by drugs. It was a very, it has its delicacies when it comes to political correctness and sensibility that they felt. I didn't feel that really. I mean, I felt the book was very humanistic and I didn't have a problem.
Well, they're going to be reactive no matter what.
Right. So
sensitive.
So I got in the room with them and the room, it was clear they were asking me if I would be willing to have another writing partner, and I sort of saw where it was going.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I certainly would work on the scripts with Jimmy Ishimura, and I got a blank, that doesn't help us.
Yeah.
And
right.
And I said, or David Mills, who was my friend from college, who had written my first script with. He was at the time, he'd done a couple of years on NYPD Blue and he was working on LA Law. And they said, you know David Mills? I said, yeah, we went to college together. He's one of my best friends.
Yeah.
Can you get David Mills to, needless to say, David Mills is an African-American writer.
Right.
So that was like—
That's the way that works.
Yeah, that's why I did that without Ed Burns. I did it with David Mills because that's the only way to get it done. They needed the racial cover of knowing
It wasn't a quota hire because you're buddies with him.
I was happy to work with David Mills.
Of course.
I told the whole story to David Mills, and he was cracking up.
Right.
He goes, that's how I got the job. I go, no, David, they also know, you know, they knew you by rep and by name. As soon as I mentioned the name, he goes, I know, I'm busting balls.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my friendship with David by then had gone well beyond sort of the racial dynamic.
Sure, of course.
But there was this moment of, oh, I get it. You guys really need a black writer on this.
Okay. Yeah. I found that in The Wire, what was, you know, interesting and amazing to me was really the one character at the end of it all that is actually transformed is Bubbles.
Yeah.
And that, you know, at the end of it all, you know, this sort of, you know, the almost the real victim of drugs on a human level outside of, you know, the politics or the sales or anything else is the hopeless addict. And, you know, and at the end of that whole thing, you know, Bubbles is kind of okay for them.
And not through any act of the war on drugs.
No, right.
You know.
Yeah, no, it was just that, like, the human story, like, to me, like, at the end of that, like, because it's a devastating period of time you spend in that world.
Right.
All of them.
Right. And Bubbles, man, we needed to throw some honest hope. And the truth is, you get to be about the age that Bubbles was.
Yeah.
And that's when guys start coming out of it.
Yeah,
when they hit bottom and they're in their 30s, you know, the guys who are in their 20s who get, you know, there's a reason that it's like the 10th or the 11th time you go to treatment,
right,
that it finally sticks.
Yeah,
and it's
if you live.
Yeah, if you live.
Yeah,
and if you don't go to jail. And
right.
You know, but I mean, if the guys who truly make it stick in the end, their bodies are a little tired, their minds are a little tired. They've been on the spin cycle for a long while.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young and you're strong. You know, you do your 28 days, and around day 21, you start asking the guys coming in what the hot corners are and what the good product is.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are the guys who, I mean, I know guys like Bubbles who are clean now for 20, you know, I mean, George Epps, the guy who was blue in the corner, he passed away, regrettably, he was clean for 20 years after he walked away from the shooting gallery that his house had become. And he stayed clean, and I was proud to know that man. I mean, it was a hero's journey.
Yeah, no, I see a lot of it. You know, I'm clean myself. You know, I'm sober, and you know, just that. You know, I always get moved by those stories that you know that because understanding that struggle on a personal level and seeing what people go through with that without trivializing it. You know, because a lot of times people who do not have the compulsion or a family member. Or a friend who has gone through the hopelessness of that thing,
right?
They don't get it.
It's like, well, just stop.
Exactly.
You know, listen, stopping is almost the least of the problems. Like, okay, now I popped out at 28 days. I feel clean. I feel strong. Yeah. But I'm walking back to the same people, places, and things, as they say in the rooms. You know, and my life is still got the holes in it. It had when I went down this path.
And yeah.
So, I mean, the work just begins once you get sober.
Yeah, because, sober. Like, you know, somehow or another, you have to get that to that point, however you're going to do it, to where the obsession, you're relieved of the obsession.
Right.
Where it doesn't become the thing, you know, the first thing you go to, and then you can't stop the hunger for it.
Right.
That's a tricky bit of business.
Right. It really is. And I mean, I came to admire a lot of those guys. And, you know, people like... The younger guys. I mean, of the kids that we followed in that rec center for the corner.
Yeah.
One of them is out of jail now, and he's working a job. He's got a forklift operator, and he's doing okay. And he's got a girlfriend, and he's, you know, he's coming up on 40. And I have hopes, Dante. Last I heard from him when we talked, he was doing good. And another kid who never went to the corner. He was like a stoop kid. Never left the stoop. He did great. I mean, he moved out to the camp. I mean, he had, you know. But everybody else, they're gone. They're gone, man.
You keep in touch with these guys?
Yeah, I mean the ones who are alive. Most of them are not alive.
Right. How do you check in with them, and what compels you to sort of stay on top of their lives?
Well, I mean, Fran became a friend.
Yeah.
DeAndre's mother became a friend, and she's clean, and she moved her family over the city line up in Northeast, you know, my kid grew up with DeAndre's kid. They were born about the same year, and they know each other. And I mean, I've just—it's been an honor to know her. You know, it's like it's broadened me. It's not that. I know her whole family, and she's been doing good for so long that it's, you know, her nieces and nephews
Never saw her going
through college.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
She survived all of her. She has an older brother who's clean, and everybody else is gone.
Yeah,
in the family, and she
fucking brutal, man.
Yeah, she's ended up being the rock.
Yeah,
and so you know, not only would I want to support that just to support it, but
yeah,
I've come to really enjoy her.
Yeah,
so there's that.
Yeah,
and. You know, some of it, it's been hard to keep up with people, you know.
Sure.
Once they're in the wind, I mean, I heard about RC passing away.
Which one is RC?
RC was one of DeAndre's friends
from
the rec center and from the drug corner. And he died maybe 3 or 4 years ago and I heard about it 2 weeks late. I mean, somebody came up to me in the market and said, "Did you hear about RC?" I was like, "Oh, no." You know, last I'd heard, he'd gone to stay with his mother's people in New Jersey.
Sure. And I guess these are people you spend a year with on some level.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, listen, I stayed in touch with some of the detectives.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, to this day, I regard Terry McLarney as a philosopher. He's still in the force. I regard him as a philosopher king.
You know? Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Every time he opens his mouth, I feel like writing it on a cocktail napkin because he's so funny.
Yeah, it's amazing, those kind of guys, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's just, you know. So, I mean, I don't think, you know... The trick is not detaching. To write that stuff, you got to love your characters. You got to love the people you're writing about. Genuinely love them. The trick is not going native. You don't have to worry. I mean, the trick is putting in the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's being honest about, you know,
and being respectful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're being granted access, you know, write the whole human being.
Yeah.
If you can do that, you know, not everybody. The detectives didn't like everything in the book,
but they got it.
They got it.
Right.
And. The same thing happened on the corner.
Yeah.
To a degree.
And with Tremé, was that sort of a departure? Was that a different world for you? You know, what kind of pulled you into that?
I wanted to write something that affirmed for the city.
Yeah.
For the idea of the American city being this pluralistic, multicultural phenomenon that not only do we have to master it, it's our future.
Yeah.
Is urbanity. It's the world's future. We either got to master it and love it and triumph with it, or we're shit out of luck.
Right.
You know, the society is, and so I was a little bit taken aback that people watched The Wire, which was specifically about the parts of my city that got left behind. It was not about, it wasn't about Roland Park or Mount Washington or Federal Hill, or, you know, the neighborhoods that are of the viable America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the schizophrenia right now, between the haves and the have nots in this country has only been accelerated. And so I was astonished to see people watch the show and go, man, Baltimore's a mess, and why don't they just move? Why don't they just leave? Like, and go where?
Right.
Camden, New Jersey? Go where?
Yeah.
D.C.?
Yeah.
You think this is unique to Baltimore? But there was that kind of callow response on the part of some people. As if they were looking at something that was an aberration rather than the actual stratification of our culture.
Right.
So I thought, you know what, the contempt that I'm hearing, the implied contempt from people who are living out in some gated community somewhere for the lives that other Americans are living, made me mad. And where can you go to be honest about an American city that has the same problems as Baltimore, which New Orleans clearly does,
right?
But nonetheless has its culture out in the street.
Right.
The culture is demonstrable. It's out, you know, they literally parade with it every Sunday.
Yeah.
And not only that, has given these great cultural gifts.
To
America. I mean, you know, jazz comes from about 8 square blocks of back of town, New Orleans. And I found that an argument for the city was actually necessary after The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, Tremé was an opportunity.
And you moved through the music too.
Yeah, the music.
That was
the music becomes
portal in.
Yeah, it becomes, you know, certainly we try to do stuff with comparable, you know, visual arts and culinary and stuff. But the music was a metaphorical means of saying, this doesn't happen without, you know, people of color, without white people, without, you know, jazz only happens in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen in West Africa. It doesn't happen in Europe. It happens, you know, from you're a musician, you'll know this, you know, from the pentatonic scale with a flatted third and a flatted seventh, which is a West African dynamic.
Yeah.
And from instrumentation and musical logic that is distinctly European.
Yeah.
You know, the reason that jazz bands probably got their kick at the time they did was all the bands coming back from the Spanish-American War
right.
dumping their instruments, all the military bands dumping their instruments when the boats hit the docks. You know, you could pick up everything from a sousaphone to a trombone for nothing.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, you know, literally within
it's invented.
Five. Yeah. Buddy Bolden within three, 4 years.
Yeah.
Using, you know.
Was he a cornet? Was he a
trumpet? He was a cornet. Yeah. Yeah. He was a cornet player. Never recorded.
Yeah.
Everyone just says,
mythological being.
You should have heard Buddy Bolden play, but you can't. You
know? And then you get to Louis and from him, right?
Yeah. So, I mean. You know, it only can happen because we're the wonderful mutts we are,
right?
Culturally, and it's a triumph of our pluralism. And so, it was a great metaphor for arguing for the city.
And with Generation Kill, because it seems that you cover very intensely and very powerfully these struggles. And what brought you to initially to deal with the military?
That one came from HBO. HBO had optioned the Rolling Stone articles, and then the book by Evan Wright. And Carrie Antholis, who had been the exec on the corner, on the miniseries side, sent it to me and said, "What do you think? You know anybody for this?" And he was, he was trolling, and I put the hook right in my mouth. And that book, I thought, was some of the most honest journalism to come out of the war. And it was, to me, it was a great critique of young men at war and sort of what we ask of our sort of the modern military culture and the warrior culture that sustains it, because it's no longer the volunteer army. It's not the Army of Vietnam. Those young men wanted to be there. That they had trained for it. It was what they do.
The new army.
They do.
It is a volunteer army.
It's an absolute volunteer army. And it's not like they're getting just people who can't find a job, so I got to go in the army. That's the myth. No,
right.
They were getting all kinds of people who wanted to be basically, a warrior class who seek this life and this structure and this commitment and this journey.
Yeah.
And our notion that this is the fallout from a bad economy is a little indulgent on our part. When you actually look who those guys were. Now, of course, that was a recon unit, a Marine recon unit.
Yeah.
But then the other thing that you could play against that, and fairly so, because it was the truth, which was they went with a very two-dimensional idea of what the war was and wasn't. And then once you get on the ground and they started going towards Baghdad.
I realize it's a little more complicated.
There was an incredibly good tactical plan to capture Baghdad, and they did magnificently.
Mm-hmm.
The strategic plan beyond that of what to do with it once you had it.
Yeah. Still unclear.
Still unclear. Right. Still unclear. And other people got to that in different ways. I mean, if you read Rick Atkinson's book, I mean, he famously quotes Petraeus as saying, explain to me how this ends.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people couldn't see it. But to see it dawn on a lot of these, very competent 21, 22, 23-year-old, those guys, the squad leaders, some of them 23 years old, calling in airstrikes on their own because they were that capable of small unit tactics. These were not stupid guys, and they were absorbing what was happening before their eyes as they moved into Baghdad and as they acquired this society without sufficient numbers or credibility or authority to do anything, but see it go bad.
Well, what happens now? What are you working on?
I'm working on a piece that should be commercially viable for the first time in my life. It's about porn.
and you say that what do you mean commercially? You're doing fine. Now you want to see?
No, I could actually have a hit.
Oh, okay.
The truth is, I'll fuck it up. I'm making a show about the rise of the sex industry after from 72 to 86 when in that window between of community standards only applying and until the Miller decision in 73, there was this window that. Basically, they drove a truck through, which was hardcore pornography became a legitimate industry.
Right.
And the sex industry exploded out of the shadows, and sort of ground zero for that was Times Square. So it's about Times Square and about when Times Square went to hell from 72 to about 86.
Did you read the Friedman book, The Tales of Times Square?
Yeah, I did. I've read everything.
Well, that one essay, which they cover a little in Boogie Nights, you know, the transition from the quarter machines to video was with from the booths to the home.
Marty Hotus.
Yeah.
Marty Hotus, yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And you know, that moment of oh my God, I just pulled, you know, $10,000 in 4 days. I got to carry it all to the bank in bags.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, what happened, to me, it's a story about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, you think that capitalism is going to point the way to a better society, that the markets will show us the way untethered
mm-hmm.
to any sort of moral imperative of what's right and what's wrong and who gets used and what happens to labor. And
yeah.
Because the people who are the labor for this stuff, the you know, particularly the women, of course, you know, the pioneers of this brave new industry were fairly well brutalized, if not, you know, on camera, if not the on camera people. There was a whole sort of subculture that they were coming out of, which was, you know, the pimps and the hookers and,
mm-hmm.
and the massage parlors up and down 42nd Street. And it's interesting when there's no overt industry, and then suddenly there it is. It's, you know, here it is. It's the Wild West.
Right.
Write your own rules. And that's what we're trying to capture. So you hear me say that, and you realize, my God, this guy's going to shoot a show about porn and, you know.
It's going to be the most unsexy thing in the
right.
world.
He's going to. It would take David Simon to ruin a show about porn and make it unfun. And you know.
Well, I mean, but no, I think that's I think that's the right way to do it, because I don't think we look at it like that. And I think it gets, you know, and obviously I've watched porn. I understand porn. And I'm sort of constantly amazed at the complete pornification of our culture
right.
to the point where, like, I remember vaguely in the 80s that there was a commission put in place, some sort of moral mise commission to sort of limit this stuff. And at some point, it was just like, nope, it's going to be everywhere. And
right.
it's going to be accepted, and it's going to completely change.
It's changed the demeanor of how
of sex,
of how we talk. But, right. I mean, it really did. And of course, the people who were first in the door, which
yeah.
would have been like the mob in New York, which
right.
bankrolled a lot of the shit, the mafia, and a lot of the people in the sort of New York culture, there are not that many survivors. There are some survivors, but man, the attrition rate was pretty heavy.
Yeah,
because you know it wasn't like anyone was looking out for anybody, and.
Well, the guys who were at the top making the money didn't, you know, they looked at the people who were in the movies and the right. women primarily as disposable, and there was plenty right. of them.
Well, actually, and they did that so badly that, you know, it all moved to the San Fernando. It came out here because, you know, in some ways you needed even the backwash from the entertainment industry to handle even the It might be degrading, but it doesn't have to be that degrading as what was happening in New York.
Because, and we got camera guys out here, and we got guys who can
right,
make room.
Right, we have there's some
plenty
right.
of willing people.
Right, but I mean, like, if you look at the sort of the mob's ability to actually run a functional business,
yeah.
these are guys who, like, you know, you hand them a casino and they bust it out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like right, they went, here, print money, print your own money. No, I'd rather steal for myself. You know,
right.
they've always been short-term guys.
So and, where do you take it up to?
Just 86 when the same cops that were being paid off for 14 years kicked in the doors.
Uh-huh.
And that was, you know, Koch, and it was the HIV outbreak, and he needed to be egalitarian about what he was closing. He needed to close the bathhouses down
yeah.
in the village genuinely for, you know, they had a health crisis.
Right.
But he did not want to be perceived for various political reasons, you know, practically as being anti-gay. And so he needed to kick in the doors of a lot of massage parlors and stuff up on 42nd Street, even though there wasn't an outbreak
right.
associated with the heterosexual
right.
Sex industry.
Oh, right.
It was, you know, sure, there was some stuff on the
So fringe. You do the classic David Simon multi-tiered levels of the capitalist culture
we
and
try.
Political culture
we try.
All the way down to the
and
two
you,
on the bed.
And you try not to make, like critique porn by making porn. You
right.
know? If we make it, if we film this thing and it's too prurient, then we're assholes. And if we're too Puritan, if we're like standing on high and judging people for the sake of judging them, we're too Puritan.
But you're pretty good at balancing.
You got to land. This one you got to land on the fence. You know. It's,
yeah. And who's involved, actor wise, producer wise?
James Franco and
yeah.
Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Wow.
Two of our leads.
Yeah.
It's a very deep cast.
Oh, great. And when are you going to run for office? When does that happen? When do you realize that's the Faustian deal, David? Yeah.
At that point, the ghost of my father really starts to spin. I mean, that's too much Faust.
Yeah,
that's way too much Faust.
All right. Well, I'll hold you to that to some degree. You have no desire.
No, at all. You know what? Mencken said famously that reporters live the life of kings.
Yeah.
And I used to say that about myself when I was making union scale and working at the Baltimore Sun. I felt that way to me.
Yeah.
That, like, why would I descend
right.
like running for city council?
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know, I'm on this exalted level. I'm a city reporter.
I'm the truth. Yeah, I can't, you know.
I know it's bullshit, but it felt real to me.
Yeah,
and
I don't think it is bullshit.
You know, it felt that way. And okay, the paycheck's bigger, and they're letting. And I, this weird sinecure at HBO lets me do TV, but the truth is, I feel as if I've not taken so many steps away from my original intent in doing this kind of TV that I have to
make the compromise where your soul would hurt.
Or where I woke up one day and said, "Oh my God, you know, yeah. I have to go in the call room,
yeah,
and I got to raise $10,000 in $4,000 increments.
Yeah.
Or, I'm sorry, $100,000 and $4,000. You know, like,
yeah.
The other thing I'm working on right now is a show about Capitol Hill with Carl Bernstein and some other people.
Oh, that's great.
And
how's he doing?
He's Carl.
Yeah,
he's Carl.
Did you like Spotlight?
I loved Spotlight. Yeah,
that's good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I introduced the film in D.C. On a panel in D.C. and
it's been a long time since someone captured the thrill of reporting.
You know, any film that has a minute and a half, maybe even 2 minutes, maybe even 2.5 minutes,
yeah.
I really would love to time it one time, of just guys looking through the Catholic directory, finding names and putting them in an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
When that's your action sequence,
yeah.
You got me. You're in my wheelhouse. You know.
What else do you watch? Anything?
Sports.
Yeah. TV shows?
Movies.
Yeah,
movies.
Mostly movies.
I don't watch TV shows in real time. When people say to me, "Oh, you should see this thing. This was great." You know,
yeah.
Then I'll go get all of them and
sure.
do it.
It's hard to make the time until somebody tells you.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, there's just so much out there now that I need
right.
I need somebody in the business to say, "No, they did something good here. That you should pay attention to this."
Well, you keep doing good things, man. It was great talking to you.
It's great. Thanks for having me out here. Here I am in Obama's chair.
And your wife's happy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. My wife was very impressed to know I was doing this gig.
I can't believe that.
No, yeah. She, like,
well, I hope we did good.
She'll let me know.
Okay.
And I'll let you know.
All right. That's a fucking solid guy, that David Simon. Solid, smart, righteous in a good way, creates great shows. It was a privilege to talk to him. And again, go to the new WTFpod.com. Enjoy. I will be doing some weekly shows at the Tripany House here in LA, where they have a parking lot. It'll probably be like a $5 ticket that benefits the theater. And you can watch me ramble through material with reasonable expectations and in a nice, intimate space. So go check the calendar for that stuff. And what else? Enjoy. I get to play guitar. I'm hurting my ears, though. I'm hurting my ears with the guitars. I do not know how to mic properly.